One of the things that we've tried to communicate as clearly as possible, even though it's a very dense subject, is why open blockchains matter. And that was in part a response to a lot of the development of enterprise-level blockchain solutions that we were worried would garner the attention of policymakers to the detriment of the open technology. Say, oh, well, now that we have this sanitized Bitcoin without the Bitcoin, that's the technology, that's the root innovation. We don't have to worry about the policy issues facing the open stuff, and maybe we could even regulate it or destroy it or things like that. No one ever suggested that, but that was our concern.
Hi, everybody. This is Mike, and you're listening to an all-new episode of the Monero Monitor podcast. Today, I've traveled down to Chinatown in downtown Washington, D.C. to speak with Jerry Brito and Peter Van Valkenburg of Coin Center about the regulatory environment surrounding cryptocurrencies, congressional attitudes towards privacy issues in the space, and how privacy coins like Monero might be treated in the future. For those of you unfamiliar with Coin Center, it's an advocacy and research group focusing on public policy issues surrounding cryptocurrencies. Jerry is the executive director of Coin Center, and Peter is Coin Center's research director. Peter's also a member of the Zcash Foundation and board of directors, which hopefully means that as we talk about these privacy issues, he's probably given them some thought. Gentlemen, thank you for hosting me today, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Would you each mind giving us a quick background about yourselves and what you do here at Coin Center?
Sure. As you said, I'm the executive director. Before coming to Coin Center, I was at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. And I was there for 10 years. And there I started and directed something called the Technology Policy Program. And so we were looking at the regulation of technology broadly. So that goes from old school telecom issues, privacy, copyright issues, but increasingly it was towards the end of my time there, more and more emerging technology issues, so 3D printing, drones, autonomous vehicles, and cryptocurrencies. And by the time that I was by the end of my time there, I was spending almost all of my time on cryptocurrencies. So really, my whole career has been in tech policy. Before that, I was at the Cato Institute. So it's been in think tanks my whole career and always focused on tech policy.
And I was in law school around 2012 and 2013. First found out about Bitcoin, got really interested, almost set up a mining rig in 2012, but decided to study for my contracts exam instead, which is a big regret because I got a bunch of law school debt instead of a bunch of Bitcoin. When I was in law school, I wanted to study technology law, especially internet law, so stuff to do with copyright and privacy primarily. When I got out, I came down to DC to work at a more general tech policy think tank through a Google fellowship. They've mostly focused on telecom issues and copyright, and I was excited to do that, but I still had Bitcoin in the back of my head, and Jerry, who we know each other from Twitter and common circle of friends, came to me and said, "Hey, I see you're in D.C. now. How'd you like to be the director of research at a Bitcoin think tank?" And I think I laughed at him and then immediately said, "Yes, that sounds awesome. You really have funding for that." So that was 3 years ago now, the beginning of Coin Center, and been here ever since, trying to make the world safe for innovation.
Okay, cool. So I've actually heard you talk, Peter, before on a podcast called Epicenter.
Yeah.
That was a few months back. And then I've heard you both talk through YouTube videos before Congress. And so anybody who's listening, if you're interested in details that we don't cover today, I encourage you to go look up some of those different resources. They both provide a lot of valuable information, I think, about the regulations in the space. Before we start talking about kind of privacy issues, I do want to hit on one more bit just to cover our bases here. So, Peter, you are a member of the Zcash Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And then I know that Zcash also sponsors Coin Center as well as a number of other companies. Can you just real quick tell us about what it's like to partner with Zcash and why you decided to do that? And then also just real quick, what these companies' involvements are. Are they just a funding source, or are they liaising with
you? Yeah, so why don't we start with the second question first.
Okay.
So it's important to understand what Coin Center is and what we do and what the relationship is with the folks who support us. So Coin Center is an independent nonprofit. And what that means is that we're not a trade association. We don't represent any company. So a typical trade association, like the Internet Association, right? The Internet Association has membership, Google, Facebook, Amazon. These are all members of the Internet Association, and they pay a membership fee, and then the Internet Association represents those companies and lobbies on behalf of those companies before Congress and then to different agencies, et cetera. And that's not what we are. And we don't have membership. We don't have any members, and we don't represent any companies. We don't represent any particular technology or cryptocurrency or anything. We're an independent organization, which means that our members, well, we don't have members, but our supporters don't direct our activities the way that Google and Facebook and Amazon direct the activities of the Internet Association. Our model, because we're independent, is more like EFF. So we have supporters. People are welcome to support our agenda. We set our own agenda. So me, Peter, we set our own agenda, and folks are welcome to support that. And at the end of a year, if they like what we did over the course of that year, they're welcome to support us for another year. And if they don't like what we do, they can walk away. So about half of our support comes from companies and investors in the space, and that includes the Zcash company, but it also includes Coinbase, BitPay, BitGo, Zappo. It includes the Ethereum Foundation. It includes, who else did they under?
Andreessen Horowitz.
Andreessen Horowitz.
Union Square Ventures, so some of the venture capital firms.
Right. Yeah. The other half of our funding comes from individuals.
Yeah.
So not companies in the space, but people who just care about this technology.
And I'm guessing people can probably guess at some of those names just thinking about the space, but then it's also on your website. So if anybody's interested in all just go check out their website.
Yeah. And also there are a lot of folks who are just individuals you might be able to guess, but it's also people who just give us $50.
Okay. Yeah. And Jerry mentioned the Electronic Frontier Foundation as a good model. So like the Internet Association and the Electronic Frontier Foundation are usually on the same page about everything, because what matters to the big internet companies generally also matters to the rights of users and developers of the technology. But they could diverge in some areas. And so that's basically how we see our relationship with industry or any of the specific projects in this space, is we mostly want to look out for the technology broadly. And by technology, I mean open blockchain networks, which we can talk about like what we think fits into that bundle and what doesn't.
Suffice it to say, for you in a bit about
Monero
that.
Definitely fits into that. Zcash fits into that. Ethereum fits into that. But a consortium blockchain like R3 probably doesn't fit into that. Not that we have anything against those projects, but that's not what we take as our constituency.
Right. And the reason is that these open blockchain networks, like Monero, like Bitcoin, like Zcash, these are open source projects that are unowned resources. They are public goods. And so as a result, you need an independent organization to look after the technology broadly and the rights of users.
Yeah, and that's actually, Peter, something you hit on quite well, I thought, in that Epicenter podcast. So if anybody has more questions about that, maybe that's a good resource.
Right, so Zcash Foundation. I'm on the board of directors. I was asked by Andrew Miller, who was sort of the first board member, to flesh out that early board. It is a jumpstart board, so I may not long-term be on the board of directors of the Zcash Foundation. I think they want to ultimately have a more, community-based membership. But the reason why, primarily I think it's because through our work in advocacy, I became personally acquainted with Zuko, who of course is the founder of the Zcash company. And he started telling us about Zcash and some of the issues he was having, some of his concerns about regulation and law. And we were, of course, always happy to be helpful to people who come knock on our doors and ask for our opinion as to what the state of play is and what we think is happening and where there might be risks and where there might be opportunities. So sort of cultivated that relationship for a while. And Zuko eventually asked me, and actually Jerry as well, alternatively, or both of us, if either of us would be interested personally, not in our capacity at Coin Center, but personally to take place in the multi-party compute ceremony to generate the ZK-SNARK parameters at the launch of that network. And he'd told us a little bit about what this ceremony was going to entail and what it might be, and I found it fascinating. I think I have decent OPSEC, so I thought, well, maybe I could make a go of this and really try and do it right, so it's less likely to be compromised, at least on my end. I did not rent a car like Peter Todd and drive across the Canadian wilderness to do it, so I kind of ended up feeling bad afterwards that all I did was barricade myself in my apartment. But anyway, I took part in the ceremony, and I think that in many ways knitted me personally to a lot of the people in the Zcash space. So it became an obvious fit for the Zcash Foundation, because I'm not an investor in the company, which gives me, I think, a little bit of independence. The goal of the Zcash Foundation is to gradually, over the 3 years that the block reward to the company winds down, take the reins of development and push it into an open community context so that it's not this centralized project that's mostly based on the efforts of a few people at the company. So as someone not invested in the company, I think I fit that role pretty well, and I'm honored to have been asked to join that board and try and flesh out that organization at the early days.
Great. Okay. Yeah, thanks for that. I don't plan on asking any questions about that going forward, so just thought it'd be interesting to hear that take from your perspective and why you got involved. Okay, so I'd like to ask you a bunch of specific questions, but first I thought it would be interesting to kind of highlight some news that's been going on lately and places where you all have been involved. So I think pretty prevalent in the news, if you've been following the last few months, has been this case between Coinbase and the IRS involving a John Doe summons. And you all were very quick to kind of respond to the IRS and point out places where you thought that perhaps they were overreaching. And then also there's been a ruling here recently that I think, Peter, you wrote about that is perhaps in favor of Coinbase customers and against the IRS. Can you all just fill us in on what it's been like becoming involved in that and maybe some of these initial rulings that have come down that might be of interest to listeners interested in privacy?
Sure. So we really haven't been involved any more than any sort of third party watching from afar and yelling at at the cloud. I think what you're referring to is when the IRS first issued what's a John Doe summons is a name for what they did, essentially telling Coinbase that Coinbase needed to turn over the names and personal information, including transaction histories of hundreds of thousands of their customers. When that first occurred, I think we immediately put out an op-ed in American Banker where we explained that essentially this is a general warrant, which the Constitution explicitly prohibits. So among other things, that you know that's kind of first and foremost. It's a sweeping request for all kinds of information based on very, very thin predicate, right? One of the things that the IRS points to is a Huffington Post article saying that Bitcoin can, you know, may be used for criminal activity, therefore give us the records of hundreds of thousands of people. So aside from that, writing that op-ed and blogging about it, you know, here and there, we haven't been too involved. At this point, we're getting to a point in the court proceedings where there might be an opportunity for what's called a friend of the court brief to be filed, and we may file one of those. But some of the interesting things that have happened in the case is that essentially the summons, it's a summons that the IRS gives to Coinbase and says, give us information about your customers. The Coinbase has very rightly said to the IRS, no, we're not going to comply. We won't give you that information. At that point, the IRS has to go to the court and ask the court to enforce the summons. It's not auto-enforcing. And so now there is a case, U.S. versus Coinbase. And Coinbase is basically saying, this is overbroad. At the same time, you have had customers who would be affected by this, whose information would be turned over, go to the court and say, we'd like to intervene in this case and become party to the case. And part of the reason for doing that is, while Coinbase is going to do, I think, a very good job of fighting this case, ultimately it's not Coinbase's data that's going to be handed over to the IRS. It's going to be the customer's data. And so some customers may want their own lawyers, their own representation, standing up for their rights. And secondly, I think some people, you know, might think, and it's not unreasonable to think, that Coinbase at some point might reach an agreement with the IRS to say, okay, well, we'll comply and drop the case. And so, a user will want to have their own representation there. And so the first thing you had is you had one person file for intervention, saying, you know, go to the court and say, we want to be a party to this case. And what the IRS did, which was quite frankly underhanded, is that the IRS said, you know what, we are retracting the summons and we are issuing a new summons, which is all of the same people minus this person.
Right. I remember there was, they basically said that now that you've identified yourself, you no longer have to be a John Doe.
You're not a John Doe, so you're not part of who we're suing.
Which is incredibly, incredibly underhand. And so...
So if everybody just comes forward and reveals themselves, the whole suit will go away. Right. Oh, but that's actually what the goal of the suit was.
and so what happened is, okay, fine, he's out. But some other users have come forward and have come forward as John Doe's. And the court has shielded their names, and they have now said, we want to intervene. And what happened most recently is that, the number one, the IRS modified the terms of its
summons.
Of its summons, where now it's they're only seeking information about folks who have made transactions in excess of
$20,000.
So that reduces the universe of people from hundreds of thousands to I'm not sure how many right now. I'm not Coinbase would know that what the number is. I don't think it's been made public. So that's one thing, is that it makes the universe smaller, so it's not such an overreaching thing. But in any event, what's happened is that some of those John Doe interveners no longer fit the category, but there is one that still does, and the court just approved the intervention. So now you have an independent party to the case. So even if Coinbase were to settle now or agree to enforce it with the IRS, you still now have a John Doe who will continue to fight the IRS. And in granting that intervention, the court, I think, was very explicit in sort of saying, look, the IRS is not making any good case why this isn't incredibly overbroad, right? Like, following the government's logic, they could go to any bank and ask for anybody's information at any time, for all customers' information, without any kind of warrant.
There's sort of two big constitutional issues here related to privacy law. Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, the Fourth Amendment, which protects our right against warrantless search and seizure. One is that, as Jerry mentioned earlier, warrants are supposed to have a certain amount of specificity. Now, there's no warrant in this case. This is a summons, because in fact, according to other aspects of constitutional privacy law, warrants aren't even required in this situation because these business records are being held by a company, not by an individual. But anyway, if you look at this like a warrant, it's incredibly broad. It's the kind of warrant that we basically were revolting against back in the early days of the revolution. It's where, you could sweeping decree, get information about everyone in the city of Philadelphia, And that's problematic when you have literally 500,000 Coinbase customers who are affected by this summons, whose privacy is affected, and not just records of their transactions or the amount that they hold, but also details of their interactions with Coinbase support, possibly information about who they were transacting with. So with a mosaic theory of information privacy, you could gather together a ton of information about people. And as these networks grow to the extent where they're used more day-to-day and transactionally, as we definitely hope and expect them to ultimately grow, we need to set the right precedents now to protect privacy, because if all of that information is public, and that's interesting because it's whether it's public on the blockchain, and if there's a way to solve that, or whether it's public because of government spying, these networks simply aren't going to work. It's too non-private. The other constitutional law issue is what we call the third party doctrine, which is the reason why they can do it with a summons and not a warrant. Basically, there's a history of case law that says if you've given over business records or personal information or private information over to a third party, you have actually lost your reasonable expectation of privacy over that data. And therefore, the government can go to the person holding that data for you without a warrant and just unilaterally summon that information from them, rather than having to go to a judge and get a warrant, which is a more difficult process. The third party doctrine was actually born in bank secrecy law. So the question of whether the government had the authority to just mandate that banks do a certain amount of suspicious activity reporting or currency transaction reporting about their customers, whether that was constitutional. And the Supreme Court back in the 1970s said, yeah, you don't need a warrant for that. You can just go get it. Since then, of course, we've seen an avalanche of even more data being aggregated by third-party intermediaries, not just banks, but of course companies like Google with Gmail or any number of other web services that you use who collect personal information about you. And generally speaking, none of that information is subject to a warrant requirement because of this third-party doctrine. So the amount of information now at risk of being collected without a warrant has grown exponentially since we worked out that case law a long time ago. And it might be reasonable to reinvestigate that case law now and say, wait a minute, the third-party doctrine might have made sense back then when people would have a few people, like an accountant or a bank, hold information about them. But now that everyone uses the cloud for everything, we need to reinvestigate whether we want to demand warrants before government's allowed to get access to third-party data. And I think this is a great example. Coinbase has a ton of data, much more data about their customers than a normal bank does, because so much of that data is on their servers from people interacting with them every day, chat logs, records of transactions, all sorts of things. And apparently it doesn't get constitutional protections under current jurisprudence. So it's something that would be worth challenging. However, at the district court level, which we're at right now, constitutional arguments aren't usually made.
Right.
So it may not be something that comes up now. It may not come up fully until it's on appeal or things like that. But these are the underlying issues. I think they're important.
Cool. I think that's it's an interesting thing to follow. And as somebody without a legal background, it's nice to hear sort of the legal perspective of that. I also listened to you talk a little bit, and then you blogged about this here recently, that the Uniform Law Commission voted to finalize and sign you called it a model state law,
mm-hmm.
Which was about regulation for virtual currency businesses. Can you talk about what that means? And then I think you, one or both of you, might have also been involved in kind of the crafting of that law. What does this mean for the greater space?
We've been working on this for 2 years.
Over 2 years.
Over 2 years. Peter's been to all the meetings. So I think the first thing you have to ask yourself is Bitcoin regulated? Or is Monero regulated, right? Are cryptocurrencies regulated? And the answer, sadly, is yes. Not directly, because you really can't regulate a open network. But what you can regulate are users of the technology, or specific uses. And today, particular uses of cryptocurrencies are regulated by the states. And it's done state by state, and you have different laws that apply depending on what state you're in or depending on what state you have customers. So take, for example, the BitLicense. Everybody has heard about the BitLicense. So if you are in New York, where if you have any customers in New York, the BitLicense applies to you. And this is the case in every state. So if you are in California, the state's money transmission licensing law applies to you. You can just go down the line. So the state of nature is not no regulation. The baseline is that there are dozens of states that already have regulations on the books, whether they are like the BitLicense or specifically crafted with Bitcoin or cryptocurrency in mind, or whether they are money transmission licensing laws from the 70s, but to nevertheless cover cryptocurrency. And the problem is that these laws are not very clear. Do you want to say something?
Yeah. So the only state that doesn't have money transmission licensing laws is Montana. Every other state and a few territories do. So that's 53 different statutes that describe how people who engage in money transmission need to get licensed before they engage in that transmission with people in our state. It doesn't matter if the company's based somewhere else. You need a license if you have customers in our state. And in every state, the definitions of two key terms is usually quite broad and amenable to flexible interpretation. So first, it's the definition of money or monetary value. And second would be the definition of transmitting money or monetary value. So if the definition of monetary value is broad, which generally it is, it's usually something like currency, which is US dollars, or a currency substitute, which might be Bitcoin, might be Monero, might be Zcash, then you're probably amenable to being subjected to that regulation if a regulator wanted to push the issue, if they wanted to say, hey, we regulate PayPal. What is what you're doing? How is it different than PayPal? You know, you're doing it with Bitcoin. PayPal does it with dollars. The second question is, what is money transmission? And that's defined variously in every state. And in some states, it's defined so broadly as to be something like money transmission is the facilitation of the transmission of money. And it's written that broadly because many of these statutes, as Jerry suggested, were written back in the 70s and 80s, when the only way to be a money transmitter was to quite literally take some cash from one person, give them a money order, hold that cash, and then they cash the money order somewhere else to pay their electrical bill, for example. You're actually taking custody, but the statute's not drafted about taking custody. The statute's just drafted like, yeah, that's a money transmitter. So what you're doing is money transmission. We'll just define it as the facilitation of money transmission.
And to be clear, the rationale, the purpose for these laws is to protect consumers. And to protect consumers because you have certain businesses like check cashers, like Western Union type money transmitters, like money order businesses that are not banks, because banks are regulated separately in a different way. So they're not banks, but they nevertheless are in the business of, at least momentarily, holding consumer funds. They take custody of consumer funds, if only for a little bit, if only for a day or two, in order to facilitate some transmission. And so as a result of holding onto that money, they put themselves in a position of trust. Because while they're holding that money, they can go out of business, they can run away, they can be hacked, etc. And so
that's the justification for this licensing requirement.
That's right.
Only people who we've previously identified with and permission should be allowed to engage in this risky behavior. Right. Now, we're not advocating for that policy, but that is the policy that's existed, as Jerry said, since the 1970s in most states.
Okay. So we're giving you a lot of background before we get to the ULC Model Act, because it's important. Because it's important to know that this ULC Model Act doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from this baseline understanding of law that every state has some version of money transmission.
And the fundamental question, so there's two definitions. The definition of money, does it include virtual currency or money monetary value? Almost always is what my answer to that would be. The second question, what about this definition of money transmission, the facilitation of the transmission of money or monetary value? In a state with a broad definition like that, it's hard to imagine how a company like Coinbase, for example, or Zappo wouldn't fit into that definition. But it's also kind of hard to imagine how, if somebody wanted to push that definition's application, how would you say that a miner doesn't actually fit that definition?
Yeah, or a full node operator.
Or a full node operator, right. Or BitGo, who makes a multi-sig Bitcoin wallet and holds one key out of three. There's absolutely no clarity with respect to any of those activities, and those activities, along with just designing the core software or designing software wallets, are some of the most innovative activities in the space. And because those old laws are drafted so broadly, we think, and I think rightly so, all of those activities are in jeopardy of being, you know, it being mandated that people doing those activities get a license. And if they fail to get a license, then there are serious criminal penalties if somebody wanted to go after a person doing those things.
And even if it's never mandated, you just have always the sword hanging above you. And it's just going to discourage people from running a full node. Why should I, you know, run a full node if there's even the chance that one state's going to say that I was practicing money transmission without a license, and then I can go to jail? If a prosecutor wanted to find something to get me on, that's something that could get me on. Okay, so that's the state of the world. You have all these states have these money transmission licensing laws on the books. They are all unclear and could be applied to full nodes, for example, among many other kinds of people. And there's just this lack of clarity. So we have gone on ad hoc basis, state by state, when we've known that a state is interested in learning more or maybe updating their law or making sure that they're not, you know.
Or making sure that they do cover virtual currency, as some states have wanted to do, like New York, but also California and a few others that we've met with.
Right. So and when we do that, we have great success. Like we'll go, so we chatted with Illinois over a year ago when they were first considering doing this, and we chatted with them and we told them what their options were. And the ultimate result in Illinois is that the regulator said, we are interpreting the word monetary value to not include digital currency. And so we're only concerned about fiat. So if you're Coinbase and you hold fiat for consumers as well as Bitcoin, you need to get a license because you're holding fiat. But if you are offering a service that never touches fiat, You don't have to get a license. You're good to go in Illinois. That's our preferred solution. So we're glad that we were able to get to that in Illinois.
Yeah, and they issued guidance making that very clear, which is great.
So that's great. But in every other state, where you haven't had a clear statement like that, you have this ambiguity. And what the Uniform Law Commission does, as the name suggests, it is a body of academics and legal practitioners that are all volunteers. It's a private body that's very well respected. And what they do is that when they see areas of law that are starting to go, and the states are going in disparate ways, what they'll do is that they'll form a committee to look at that area of law and see if there's a way to reconcile, figure out what's the best practice, and draft a model state act. You might be familiar with the Uniform Commercial Code. It is the law that governs contracts, and every state in the nation has adopted the Uniform Commercial Code, which is why contract law is the same in every state. And this is a product of the ULC. That's probably the most successful uniform act. But they have acts for every other kind of area of law that you can imagine. I think I saw a uniform adoption.
Parentage, yeah, that was
parentage and adoption.
Hotly debated because of the issue of same-sex couples.
So you have these for everything. And so about 2 years ago, the Uniform Law Commission, seeing that the states were going in every different direction, we had the BIT license over here, which they recognized was a terrible model and something to be avoided. They put together a drafting committee, and we were very lucky to be a part of that. We filed about half a dozen comments with the committee. Peter attended every single one of the drafting
meetings.
Yeah,
and our goal throughout the whole process was to make sure that, if a new law is coming, either at the ULC as a model law or at any state that decides they do want to explicitly cover virtual currency.
Yeah, it's important to note that whether we were part of this or not, the ULC was going to come out with the model
law. They were going to come out anyway. That regardless of, if a new law is coming, that these ambiguities that we worry most about, like to make sure that non-custodial people innovating with a technology or running full nodes or mining, that they're not covered in the license, that it was crystal clear that they wouldn't be covered. So there's a few things, pieces of language that we strongly advocated for in that model act. And the commissioners, I think, who are all, roundly intelligent, smart, and actually quite caring individuals with respect to innovation and the technology, came around pretty quickly to the language we were suggesting when we explained why it was necessary. And the language we were suggesting always related to control. It's a defined term in that act. And control is defined with respect to somebody holding virtual currency for somebody else, doing an activity. And it's defined carefully to be limited only. You only have control over someone else's virtual currency when you can unilaterally execute or indefinitely prevent a transaction on someone else's behalf. And our reasoning for that is there are all kinds of people who have some involvement in the facilitation of money moving on these networks. Miners, they put transactions in blocks. In a very real way, they do actually create the transaction's immortalization. But at no point can they unilaterally create a transaction for someone else. They just take an already signed transaction and put it in the block.
Right. At no point have they ever put themselves in a position of trust.
Yeah.
That is the rationale for licensure.
And at no point can they prevent a transaction indefinitely. A miner actually can for 10 minutes if they're the one that was chosen to get the block reward for that 10-minute period in Bitcoin or different period in a different cryptocurrency, but not indefinitely. So they're clearly excluded. Also excluded would be someone like BitGo, who builds a multi-sig wallet product. Also clearly excluded would be a full node because they're just relaying signed transaction messages.
Or blockchain.info.
Or blockchain.info, a software wallet. Also excluded would be a cross-chain atomic swap if you were going to build an exchange platform that was literally trustless, that didn't involve custody. So we feel like we've opened up this big area of innovation and made clear in this law, in the drafting of this law, that those things are not subject to licensing. And I think that's unprecedented because every other state law governing money transmission, as well as the BIT license, as well as the drafts we've seen for virtual currency specific licensing in California, they've been too vague on this question. And that's, I think, a huge liability, especially when if someone can convince someone that you do fit into a broad definition, and if they're a prosecutor, they can nail you 5 years in jail for you, your investors, your employees. Because the criminal penalties are severe, so I think we need to be super careful to make sure that it's clear that certain companies and businesses and activities aren't covered in that definition. And the Uniform Law Commission, after 2 years, was very amenable to that. They said, yeah, the goal was just to regulate companies like Zappo and Coinbase. That was our remit, and was to promote innovation broadly in the space. So they were super receptive once they understood the complexities of the issue. And I really think this is a great model. You know, it still needs to be actually shared with all the state legislatures who are interested in regulating these activities. And then those interested state legislatures, like maybe hopefully California, or maybe hopefully Pennsylvania, who have already gone down this road a little bit, they'll decide to pass it into law in their states.
And that's something that the ULC then follows through with, or how does that carry out?
Yeah, that's something. So the ULC now has an enactment committee that will go and try and use their members in various states to promote this legislation.
Okay. So I think that covers kind of one of the big focuses of maybe what y'all are looking at in terms of consumer protection. Mm-hmm. But then also with privacy, there's kind of another section, and Peter, I've heard you refer to it as financial surveillance law. Most people just know it as anti-money laundering.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a really interesting topic, specifically when we're talking about things like Monero, things mm-hmm. like Zcash. And that's kind of one of the key focuses I wanted to talk about here today. You know, with a company like Coinbase, it seems straightforward enough that Coinbase is able to track through, you know, various coin tracking techniques, what their customers are doing with their funds and where funds are coming from and where they're going to, and take care of anti-money laundering, you know, related issues. But with something like Monero or Zcash, that's all opaque. And what does that then mean in terms of what these companies might need to do? And does it make things easier for them, or does it actually make things harder for them because there's no clear way to track people's funds?
So it's important to be clear what your anti-money laundering obligations are, and whether they even apply to you. So the same question of whether you're a money transmitter at the state level or not is repeated at the federal level. The federal regulator for anti-money laundering financial surveillance activities is FinCEN, which is a division of the U.S. Department of Treasury. And they issued guidance in 2013 that suggests that anyone who's an exchanger of virtual currencies is regulated under the Bank Secrecy Act, which is the law that mandates that you do certain things. You could pejoratively say spy on your users. You could optimistically say interdict terrorist funds, prevent money laundering, these things. And you have specific obligations then if you fit into that category of exchangers, which fits you into the Bank Secrecy Act. Those obligations are specific, though. These obligations are not things like you need to sign up for Coinalytics or Chainalysis and track the blockchain. Of course not. These things were written in the 70s, 80s and amended by the Patriot Act. They had no mention of blockchain back then and wouldn't be able to. But you do have to do other things. You have to basically, if you open an account for somebody, you have to collect information about them, know your customer information. You have to do suspicious activity reporting. So if there's a transaction that's over $2,000 in value and there's something strange about it, now query what that is, but there's standards, you have to actually file a suspicious activity report to FinCEN, which will then be shared as necessary with law enforcement. You have to have a reasonable customer identification program to hopefully arrive at, you know, an understanding of who your customers actually are, who's benefiting from a transaction, these sorts of things. It's not entirely clear that you need to know who your customers' customers are under the Bank Secrecy Act. So there are usually obligations that if you have information about who your customer is paying, that needs to be, you need to keep those records. But if your customer didn't provide that information, that's not necessarily your obligation because the person they're transacting with isn't your customer. So it may be unreasonable to actually require information about that. So there's usually a, if you have the information, you have to record. If you don't, you don't. Now, that's maybe where Chainalysis fits in. If you can't obtain the information about your customer's customer, maybe you should have it. But it's important to point out that that's not a mandate that you obtain that information. So from a pure black letter law standpoint, there's no reason why a company like Coinbase or Zappo would be less able to comply with anti-money laundering law if they were using Zcash or Monero instead of Bitcoin or Ether. Just because the blockchain is more opaque does not mean that that destroys your ability to comply. Now, that's the black letter law analysis. There may be business concerns or regulatory risk concerns, public relations concerns that these exchanges have. But one thing that we've always really wanted to stress is like, look, if let's say an exchange decided to start trading Zcash for dollars. As long as the people who they set Zcash accounts up for, or Monero accounts up for, or Ether accounts up for, as long as they collect information about those people that they're supposed to, and they file suspicious activity reports, that's fine. There's no law that says that they can't deal with those other currencies.
Cool. Okay, kind of going in that same vein then, I think it's clear to maybe people who are listening, it's clear to us some of these distinctions and how maybe that would then apply, but when y'all are talking then with people on the Hill and lawmakers, mm-hmm. And I know you've talked specifically about Zcash on the Hill, mm-hmm. But do they even have an appreciation for some of these distinctions? And kind of coupled with that, when they hear about something like Zcash or Monero that can totally make all transaction history opaque, are they still receptive to that like they might be to an open ledger like Bitcoin or Ether?
So I think it's something that they're beginning to think about. I think just to date, because this is the point in history where we are, Bitcoin has been sort of the dominant cryptocurrency. And it's been a dominant cryptocurrency for illicit uses. And so as a result, that has garnered most of the attention. I think that more privacy protecting cryptocurrencies are now coming obviously to the attention of law enforcement and eventually will become more and more to the attention of policymakers. So I don't think we've seen a clear reaction just yet. That said, I think that they understand a couple things. I think they understand that the relative size of cryptocurrency to cash being used for illicit uses, it's minuscule. It's relatively small compared to cash. And compared to, by the way, other means of money laundering, et cetera. And so I think that they have, and I think they will continue to place the appropriate emphasis in the right places. So I think that's one piece. I also think that they understand a lot of the benefits of this technology. This is something that Peter has pointed out. The fact is that privacy-enhancing technology doesn't just benefit criminals, it can, but it benefits the public much more. And that's a message that we have to convey. And I think you have members of Congress that are very receptive to that message, who in fact are, when we explain to them something like Bitcoin, what they say to us, that's too transparent. You'll be able to see everybody's transaction. You'll be able to see how much I'm getting paid and where I'm shopping. And then we say, well, actually, that's a problem that is obvious and folks have been working on, and we see new technologies coming. You have other members of Congress, though, who their problem is not so much with the privacy, although that's part of it. Their problem at root is going to be with the censorship resistance inherent in all cryptocurrency. And that's something that's just a cat's out of the bag on that one. And again, that's a message that we just need to convey that, look, what we need to do, what you need to do, is focus on combating the illicit uses of the technology, not focus on the technology itself.
Yeah, one of the things that we've tried to communicate as clearly as possible, even though it's a very dense subject, is why open blockchains matter. And that was in part a response to a lot of the development of enterprise-level blockchain solutions that we were worried would garner the attention of policymakers to the detriment of the open technology. Say, oh, well, now that we have this sanitized Bitcoin without the Bitcoin, that's the technology, that's the root innovation. We don't have to worry about the policy issues facing the open stuff, and maybe we could even regulate it or destroy it or things like that. No one ever suggested that, but that was our concern. So one of our big papers that I focused on was a paper called Open Matters, where I try and talk about the Internet of Things, the identity use cases for blockchain, the cash uses for blockchain, and the need maybe for just a simple cash-like settlement tool rather than some sort of bank consortium tool. And why for any of those networks, especially though for identity and Internet of Things control of devices, you want an open network. Because if you have a closed network, you just reinvent all the same problems of centralized control, of censorship, of anti-competitive behavior of all sorts of things. And one question that obviously comes up then is, okay, in the open networks, aren't they less private? That's something you actually hear from people in government. If we were to build a blockchain for health records, for example, because it's something that people in government are interested in, and it sounds like a compelling use case. If we were to do that on an open network, wouldn't that be terrible? Because then everyone's health data is public. And then the first thing to say to that person is, well, first, keep in mind the documents aren't on the blockchain, just the access control permissions and any logs of access. So the documents themselves are servers are still client-side and encrypted and things like that. But the second thing to say is, well, look, you don't want them on a closed loop, because then, you know, how do we get everyone to buy into the same system? You have the same problems of getting all the hospitals to collaborate on the same enterprise solution, and some won't, and some will go with a competitor, and these sorts of things. You have a privacy problem no matter what, because hospitals get hacked. So if it was a private blockchain, I'm doing scare quotes right now, and somebody obtained the signing keys necessary to get access to that private network, then you don't have privacy anymore. And if it's truly a blockchain where all the records are on there, even if it's private to a closed consortium, somebody hacks that system, they get access to that data. So what we need is an open system and one that is privacy protecting. And there are only a handful of technologists who have worked in this space. There's people who have developed mixing services and ultimately mixing blockchains like Monero. And there's the people working on zero knowledge proofs like Zcash. And this is where there's fundamental innovation in this space. So even if you think, yes, these things sometimes are marketed as or branded as or misconstrued as purely the tools of criminals, these are also the foundational technologies that will enable the kinds of things that we want. Things like better health records, more portable health records, things like better digital identity tools, things like better control over our Internet of Things devices, so our smart car doesn't just unlock itself when a stranger walks into it or something like that. And we'll need technologies like Monero and Zcash in order to enable that future. And just like any other technology, it'll be used for good and for evil. And on net, I think it'll be used for good. So that's been where we try and bring the conversation to when people ask us about these new blockchain technologies, is that they are fundamentally important. And they may make some things more difficult, as some technologies always have, but they're going to make a lot of things more accessible, better, easier.
Sure. Okay, I got two follow-ups to that. First off, is that I saw the Open Matters paper, and when you write a document like that, who is your target? Are you trying to get that information to lawmakers, or are you who is the intended reader there?
The impetus for that particular paper is that early on, there was a lot of focus on Bitcoin. It was pretty clear what we were talking about. Then the conversation shifted to blockchain, and then the conversation got muddied because folks on Capitol Hill, at different regulatory agencies, would ask you questions about blockchain, but it wasn't clear that they understood what kind of blockchain they were talking about or what exactly. So they might say something like, you know, we're not interested in cryptocurrency. In fact, we're not interested in talking about that. We're interested in DLT or whatever that, you know, they might say. We're interested in something that is closed, but the reason we like it is because it's immutable and
interoperable.
Interoperable, and we want it to have, you know, proof that it's and you're like, okay, but take a step back. We need to walk you through some things. And so we had that conversation so many times, so we decided we needed to, and we felt that because people began to, it was a point in time when I think folks in government began to see, wow, this blockchain innovation that Bitcoin brought along holds a lot of promise, but boy, we don't like that Bitcoin part of it. So and now we see that there's some folks who are telling us we can have blockchain without the Bitcoin. And
when they say without the Bitcoin, they really mean without the coin at all.
They mean without
Bitcoin
the coin
or Ethereum or,
right.
Exactly. Or Monero or anything.
Which you can. You could do something like that.
Although it looks a lot like Paxos, like a consensus mechanism developed in the 1980s for reconciling databases. But
that's fine. But I think that they were still thinking that it could do many of the things that blockchain with a coin,
yeah,
an open network, could do.
Things like the purported immutability, or at least the weight behind things, the difficulty of changing it, the verifiability, the public verifiability, but it's a lot of muddied thinking.
Yeah, and so just having a conversation so many times, and being concerned that folks were missing that there were a few, the most interesting, innovative things this technology makes possible are only possible on open blockchain networks.
Yeah.
Is why we decided to put it to work on this paper and stuff.
That and also the privacy stuff. So there's a big section in that paper, and if you're interested, I'd say find that section on just the privacy aspects of open blockchain networks that basically goes through, like, look, open blockchain technology is not a good solution for a lot of applications if you need privacy if you're talking about Bitcoin, because that's simply true. It's far too public and transparent. It might be good for something that you want public auditability on, but it wouldn't be good for something like identity. You shouldn't be able to query a public record and learn everything about you, Mike, without having your permission to see that information first. But we say Bitcoin is just the beginning of open blockchain networks. There's a series of follow-on innovations that either deal with mixing or with zero knowledge proofs. And we go through, we talk about Zcash, we talk about confidential transactions, which was new when we wrote the paper, baking that into Bitcoin. We talk about how there are ways to actually have global consensus over the veracity or the validity of some data without revealing all of that data publicly to everyone. And that's effectively what these networks do. They allow someone to feel comfortable that they have actually received some money from someone else without there being a clear and easily parsed record for third parties of seeing that particular change in the distribution of wealth on the network. That's Monero, that's Zcash, and the same thing would be a necessary technology to bake into, say, something like an Internet of Things or identity-based blockchain, such that when the DMV gives me a token for me to be able to prove that I have a driver's license and I have brown hair and blue eyes, I have that token and the ability to prove that I've had that attestation made about me, but someone looking at the public blockchain doesn't know, oh, Peter just got a brand new driver's license. I see when this party on the network issued it to this party on the network. It's very hard to communicate all of this to policymakers, though, but we definitely wanted to start opening this conversation because it's important, as Jerry said, to make sure that everyone knows that a lot of the innovation's coming still from the open sector, and it's important not to disregard that sector of the technology.
Right. Okay, so then you've said it twice now, and because of what you all do, being this research and advocacy group, I think it's important, both because my listeners might hang me, but then also just because I think it's important to open up this dialogue. When you say mixing, I think it's important to note, for anybody who doesn't know this, that Monero is not mixing in the sense that a mixer mixes, mm-hmm. or Dash might mix, where they take multiple transactions and they slur them all around and then spit them back out.
Mm-hmm.
Ring signatures is a little different, and if you want, after the episode or in the future, I'm happy to talk with you offline about some of those differences.
That'd be great.
Because I think that terminology is probably not accurate for talking about Monero. So, but
you'll be happy to know that I don't think we've ever talked about Monero to anybody in government.
No.
It's never come up.
I'm sure somebody that's listening probably just high-fived their friend right now. but kind of with that, this is a nice segue to maybe what can be the last question potentially. It is, when we first got in touch, you expressed a lot of interest in the interview, but you also said you thought it would be good to start reaching out to the Monero community or to Monero developers, because you already have this relationship with, for instance, Zcash, and you already have a relationship with Ethereum Foundation and some other of these groups. But you said that you'd maybe like to start building a bridge there with the Monero community. What are the types of things that the community or the development team or individuals like myself might be able to do in order to start building a connection there?
Yeah, so obviously, we started at a time when Bitcoin was kind of like the only game in town.
Right, and Monero was tiny.
Or it didn't even, I'm even thinking about, back in the first hearings in 2013, it was just Bitcoin. And when we were formed, really, there was just the reason, one of the reasons why we were formed is that there was just increasing demand from folks in government about information about Bitcoin in particular. And then that grew, as I said, into blockchain broadly and other cryptocurrencies. And so we've been focused on Bitcoin, although it's important to note that any law or any regulation, there's no regulation that's ever going to be passed that singles out Bitcoin or Monero. It's going to always be in terms of virtual currency, which is what the government calls it.
Yeah. And really in terms of activities that people do with it or don't do with it.
Right.
So we're going to focus on that.
Yeah, so we're really coin agnostic because the government is too. As you say, we've just had just initially a lot of we've come from the Bitcoin world. The Ethereum world grew up around with a lot of the same Bitcoin people, the Zcash folks. So Zuko is somebody who just became a good personal friend, and that community merged around it. And we haven't had that much connection with the Monero community. We don't have any formal way, but we're accessible. If folks want to reach out, we certainly encourage support of our work. We also, on our website, we try to have plain English explanations of different pieces of the technology. We welcome maybe doing something like that.
Yeah, a backgrounder on ring signatures would actually be a pretty useful contribution, actually.
Sure.
Basically, most of the connections we've made in this space are either people who came forward because they wanted to support our work, or we had a specific question from a policymaker one day, and we didn't have an answer. And so we said, okay,
who can answer this
really well in just like a 2,000-word document, or who could come testify maybe at this committee or things like that. And so we do periodically reach out to the community, and that's how we've established most of our relationships with people out there. And I think it's always fairly fruitful. Everything we do is public. It's all on our website, so you can see the fruits of those relationships. And it's true, like Zuko wrote our Zcash backgrounder, Vitalik wrote our Ethereum backgrounder, and in both cases I think those were situations where we had someone specifically starting to ask about, like, what is this, like, what Ethereum, why is there this, and what is a smart contract? And there's a lot of ways to misconstrue and not understand what Ethereum is, so it was great to have Vitalik be willing to just write 2,000 words.
And these will be people, when we say somebody ask, we mean folks on Capitol Hill, at the SEC, at Treasury. They just ask us. And at some point we're like, okay, we're getting this question frequently enough that it'd be great to have something that we can just hand them.
Yeah. Because the other important thing to always keep in mind is, folks in government are going to get the information one way or another.
Yeah.
And I think it's critically important that people's first perception, or at least second perception, of something new is a positive one, if there's real positive stories to be told. And in across the open blockchain space, there are extremely positive stories to be told. And it's a shame if a policymaker focuses only on a dark market or only on something negative about the technology. So being able to actually get that information on the table, I think it's hugely useful. Someone once said to me, like, it's better to be at the table than on the table, which I think is pretty right when it comes to policymaking here in DC. Most bad policy is made out of ignorance, not malice, is something we've discovered working in this space. People always said, like, oh, are the big banks coming and lobbying Congress to destroy this technology? And we've never seen any evidence of that. And if anyone was going to see it, I think it would probably be us. Mm-hmm. In general, most of the issues we find in this space are situations where, like with our description of state money transmission licensing, the law was just drafted really broadly. And then somebody who doesn't even maybe know anything about the technology is tasked with enforcing that law with this new business, this thing that's popped up. And if they're not given a friendly way to understand it, they're much more likely to do things that are going to be bad for the space. So it's good to build bridges, I think.
Cool. Well, yeah, I mean, the main reason I wanted to talk with y'all was just that it seems like you are building some of this knowledge base to pass on to lawmakers, and you are kind of doing things the right way and in the interest of users. And then specifically with privacy related things, like, you and I maybe do or don't agree on what technology best gives somebody privacy, but, like, yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat. Like, if people want to use the dark markets, whatever, but I'm interested in privacy related issues because, at the extreme, somebody's life might depend on having privacy, but even just, one of the three of us might be interested in it, like the congressmen and lawmakers that you were talking with, if our information is just out there and who we've transacted with and how much money we have and everything else, like, you know, the guy charging you rent for your apartment might up mm-hmm. your rent because he knows you have more money or right. or whatever else. And so, you know, the technology is fascinating. And so it's nice that you guys are doing this. Maybe something can come out to hopefully build a relationship here, because, you know, a lot of these stories here recently with the darknet markets, just two of them getting taken down within the last couple weeks. Monero has been in the news a lot because it, mm-hmm. they, matter of fact, there was even something, a little footnote that like, oh, we took this much Bitcoin and this much Ether and this much Zcash, and we're not sure how much Monero yet. And that kind
yeah,
of
noticed that.
Stirred a little bit of interest among some communities. And if the only thing that people know about Monero, for instance, is, oh, it's used by Alphabay, then that's not in anybody's interest, I don't think,
yeah.
From a regulation
side. On the technology side of it, like, which technology is better for privacy? Like, we said we weren't going to get into it. I don't actually have strong...
Yeah.
I'm not a cryptographer. I've come to learn about these things secondhand through people who I've established a relationship and I trust, and I believe they're doing the right thing. But the thing that I noticed that I think is most important is that there are multiple approaches. And if anything, that's what, more than anything else, Coin Center, I think, hopes to advocate for. It's not for one solution. It's
for
one
of it.
Sector of technology called open blockchain networks.
Right.
But if we end up in a world where Bitcoin becomes dominant, but people aren't allowed to start Monero or aren't allowed to start the thing that comes after Zcash and Monero, the third thing that we don't even know about now, that's a disaster for us.
Right. Yeah.
Coin Center has lost.
We failed, yeah.
We've
yeah.
failed. So... we need the dynamism, we need the competition, because there could be something deadly wrong with zero knowledge proofs.
Right.
Or there could be something deadly wrong with ring signatures, or there could be something deadly wrong with Mimblewimble or confidential transactions.
Right.
And we need to find the right one and
right.
find it soon, because as we race towards a future where all of our information's on servers somewhere, we need better ways of reconciling that information across distributed databases without making it public.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, this podcast is called the Monero Monitor, but part of that is that I'm more familiar with Monero than some of these other technologies. Part of it is that I think it present day is maybe the best one if somebody really needed privacy. But I'll be honest, I mean, if something comes along like Mimblewimble that provides better privacy, like, that's what I'm interested in. You know, mm-hmm. Monero is a tool and it happens to be something that can give some privacy today, but it's really all about protecting yeah. the space in general and protecting people's privacy.
And by the way, it's not just privacy for me anyway, it's
yeah.
also fungibility.
Yes.
You know, I not to get too sci-fi, but, you know, I think at some point we might see, you know, attempts to eliminate cash. And if we move to a purely digital economy, we have to retain the ability to have cash that is fungible and private.
Yeah.
So
the other ideological concerns, we always talk about privacy, is autonomy. And that's censorship resistance or the ability to know that you'll always be able to take an action that's consequential to your life without somebody always being able to step in and intercede.
Well, and always not just intercede, but without somebody's permission.
Without someone's permission.
Always, right? I mean,
right.
If we move to a world, and this is funny because Bitcoin and the fact that Bitcoin has spurred the greater blockchain idea, and that has just... sparked a lot of thinking from folks who are not interested in you know, censorship-resistant open blockchain networks. They're interested in that, but the idea that you could have peer-to-peer digital transactions, that has sparked a lot of thinking. And, you know, throughout banks, throughout the financial sector, and in one area where it's really sparked it is just in central banks. And in central banks, you're now having serious conversations about, well, maybe we should have national digital currencies. And what they mean by that is not a true peer-to-peer token that would be passed along the way I give you a $100 bill. What they mean are basically accounts, you know, personal accounts at the central bank.
Yeah.
That's what they mean.
Yeah.
And if you do that, then that's, it's, you know, at that point, there's nothing that you can't, there's no transaction in which you can engage, by which I mean there's no action you can take as a human that wouldn't have to be permissioned by the state.
Right.
So at any moment, you can imagine that there could be a warrant issued for your arrest, and you would just be turned off from the central bank computer, and you wouldn't be able to hail a cab or get on a subway. Or...
Yeah. Or, yeah. And I mean, fungibility can even be something as innocuous as, you know, with my podcast, I am trying not to do any kind of advertising or anything like that. And so it's a donation model. And on my website, I have an address that you can donate to.
Right.
But I would love to take Bitcoin, for instance, but I don't, because I, quite frankly, don't want to have to deal with worrying about where might this Bitcoin have come from, what might it be tied to. And maybe today it's not a big deal, but you never know. At some point, you hear all kinds of stories about people who, because Bitcoin is not fungible, what that then leads to as far as you know, some type of action by law enforcement or whoever else, even just Coinbase shutting down their account. And so it's something that, you know, it probably hampers my ability to raise funds, but at the same time, it's just a choice I made, that something that I don't want to have to worry about, you know, because fungibility matters. Yeah.
And then the right to build these networks is the one other thing I wanted to mention, because that's not a privacy issue, that's a free speech issue.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, the Monero core protocol is just computer code, and it's just, and code is speech. There's good judicial precedent on that. And so I think we have a strong value of that here in the US, a desire to protect that activity and to not have government capable of placing prior restraint on speech, basically saying you simply can never publish something related to this or to that. And it came up back in the 90s with the crypto wars, where basically RSA or any other encryption algorithm was considered a munition, a weapon, and therefore subject to export control laws. But you can publish these things on t-shirts. And Adam Back actually printed a line of t-shirts with the RSA source code basically encoded onto it. And so if you walked across a border with this t-shirt, you were trading in munitions. And it just hit home a point. And fortunately, we won the crypto wars basically the first time around. The ability to create those new technologies and share them was treated as free speech and no longer subject to that kind of prior restraint that you had in export control laws. The same thing might happen again with respect to these technologies. There might come a day where someone says, no, I don't want that thing out there. I don't want that software out there. You can't develop that software. You can't live in the US and develop that software. That'd also be a massive loss for us. So privacy, free speech, these are the things that I think fundamentally motivate us. And we hope we're doing a good job.
Yeah, awesome. Well, you've already talked a little bit about how maybe people might be able to become involved. Can you tell the listeners how they actually could get in contact with you or where they should go?
Sure. Go to coincenter.org, and you'll find all the information about us, about our work, about how you can support us. Sign up for our newsletter, follow us, get in touch with us. It's all there.
Cool. Yeah. And I know you're both on Twitter, and there are links from coincenter.org to your Twitter account. So if people are interested in that, that's there too. Well, unless you guys have anything else, you want to just call it a day?
Yeah, sounds good.
All right,
thanks for coming.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks for listening to today's show. If you enjoyed what you heard, please consider donating on our website, MoneroMonitor.com. Our podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons share-alike license, and you can find terms for that license on our website. Lastly, the music in our show is by Justin Maher, and it's also released under a Creative Commons license.